If you have your Bibles with you, be turning them on and clicking over to Psalms 76. That's where we will be at. That's where I'm going to be at. You can be anywhere else you want. You may get lost, though. So I was torn between two ways to go tonight. One, I was thinking of going the millennial route and just talking about my grandmother's funeral. And but as I was reading the psalm, and just going through the lesson that is in the psalm, as the psalm presents itself to me, I thought I'm going to do both. I'm going to go both the millennial route and teach you something, hopefully. My grandma was 103. You know, it is an interesting thing to meet a 103-year-old coming here to this church and finding Retta, who was also, she was, I think my grandmother was maybe 3 or 4 months older than Retta. My grandmother was old by the time I met her. She was 75 by the time I developed memories. My first memory was of her, and she was already sporting the old white lady fro, the permed up, and she was always a proper woman, And she had aprons sewed onto her dresses, and so by the time I, my father died when I was around 4. And so really the only time I got to spend with my grandpa was grandma was on weekends. My mom would drop us off there, and we would always drop us off at like Friday, and we'd get to her house. She lived in Lincoln, California. We lived in Yuba City and in Grass Valley. And so by the time we got to her house, it was usually late, and she had this beautiful Oldsmobile, Olds Cutlass. It was 60s. It was mint condition. It smelt like my grandparents. It was comfortable. It had a huge, the bench seat in the back went on for days. I loved that car. My cousin ended up wrapping it around a telephone pole, but that is its own mourning and grief. And so by the time we got to her house, it was late, and we were usually tired, and me and my sister would usually fall asleep on her bed, and then for some reason in the middle of the night, a magical thing would happen. Because we would go to sleep, and I'm telling you this, I was maybe 15, 16, and I was still wondering how they were doing this. Because I would sleep in their bed, but I would always wake up on the couch. And here's the thing, though. I would sleep in their bed, and then I'd wake up, and it was the same view every single time. I would wake up, my head would be on this side, and there would be a chair pushed up against the couch. And she had a heater. She would always bring out this heater. I never saw this heater ever before and ever after. It would just appear and then it would disappear. My grandma would put it somewhere. And I'm telling you, she would do this until we were like 16, 17. And it was the creepiest thing in the world. Because I would just wake up on the couch. And at first, when I was when I was a kid, I thought, there's got to be monsters in this place. There's got to be something. Because my grandma was old. I mean, my grandma, she was this tiny little dynamo of a personality, but she couldn't pick me up, like, which is what I thought, that's what she did, you know. So I'm like, oh, this place, it was always a creepy place to me. It was always where my grandma was, but at night I'm thinking, what is hidden in the cupboards that my grandma is keeping away from us? I never understood it. Later on, I obviously, as we would all know, she would wake us up and walk us out, and then she would put, and again, it wasn't until I was 20 that I finally realized, I'm like, Grandma, why'd you always put the chair up against the couch? And she said, oh, to keep you from rolling off. I'm like, Grandma, I ain't going to stop me from rolling off a couch. And then I asked her, again, this is when I was 20. I mean, I was old by this time. A lot of things happened when I was 20 with me and my grandma, but. And then finally I asked her, why the heater? Like, why always the heater? She said, like, well, one time when you were 4, you were over at our house and you said it was cold, so I just always put the heater out. Yeah, it's my grandma. What I was always amazed by, the difference between night and morning. At night, it was scary. At night, it was always a mystery. It was always what's going to happen. I remember me and my sister, we would lay awake in her bed just trying not to fall asleep because we wanted to see who was taking us out. Maybe the closet would open. We were always creeped out by the closet because my grandpa, his name was Burley, and I love this guy. He was he was awesome. Everything was suit and tie. He never went out without a suit and tie and his bowler hat on. Just proper, always a proper gentleman. Open doors, that guy, he was awesome. But whenever you opened his side of the closet, he would have his suits up there. So if you're a kid and you open up that closet, what are you seeing? You're seeing a monster that's wearing a suit, all right? You're wearing, because he had a suit ready for the next day and that my grandma put out for him. And so me and my sister would lie awake in that bed thinking, we are not going to fall asleep. We are going to figure this out. And then sure enough, we wake up and, grandma, like what? How did we get out here? You know, it makes me think of how my kids view our house. You know, right now we're going through this period where our kids are afraid of everything. Well, our girls are. Thomas is afraid of nothing. Thomas, that boy, dude, he ain't afraid of nothing. But it's cute because our girls, they are afraid of everything. And usually when you try to send them back in their room to get dressed or when we actually have them try to do anything that we need them to do, they're scared of bears. And that's what we can get out of them. They are deathly afraid of bears in our house. And so, what's that? I know, right? Don't worry, Natalie, this morning Natalie looked at me and she said, I don't know how much longer I'm going to like this. I'm like, okay, you just tell me. It's off. They're definitely afraid of bears, and that's about it. They're definitely afraid of bears, and the reality of what they're afraid of is they're afraid of being alone. Our girls are really afraid of being alone. You know, they've always had themselves, they're always together. They sleep in the same room, and they're just definitely afraid of being alone. And I think of this a lot when I get into Psalms 76, because the question, I believe that it's answering, that's causing me to ask, is what am I afraid of? What is mystical? What is something that just seems overpowering, something that's in the shadows that you just don't understand? Because that old adage is true. You know, we are afraid of what we don't understand. We are afraid of the dark. We are afraid of millennials, or we're afraid of whatever. We're afraid of things that we just don't quite understand. And this song that is sung by Asaph, he's sung by a musician, and he's trying to give a voice, a picture to the fear, to what we are scared of. And again, it's not like a lot of other psalms where it is very descriptive of the enemy. That's not what this psalm does. The psalm kind of leaves a lot of that to be guessed at, which I think is the scariest part. You know, once you turn on the lights, you know, once you discover what's in the closet, it's not really scary. If anything, it's kind of comical. You know, one of the things that in my grandma's house, and it's the one thing that we, you know, all the family wanted to know and make sure, where is it going to go? We want to make sure it goes into a good home that'll be used, and it's her clock. It wasn't a grandfather clock. I'm not even sure this thing was ancient. She could have bought it at a Goodwill. But it was her clock. And it was this clock that made a sound, you know, that it made a beautiful sound. And it represented her, you know, and it was a comforting reality of who she was. But when you are 6 or 7 and it is midnight and somehow you woke up on the couch again and that stinking clock goes off like it does every hour, kind of scares you. But in the day, it's quite the opposite. It's a comforting thing. And so that's kind of what this psalmist is doing, what this song is about. What he's trying to draw a picture of is, he's not telling you don't have a right to be afraid of something. He's telling you instead, look what's on your side. Let me turn on the lights for a little bit. Or better yet, let's leave the lights off and you realize who's in charge of your fear or who's bigger or stronger than your fear. So this is Psalms 76. I'm just going to start it in verse 1. In Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. His abode has been established in Salem, his dwelling place in Zion. There he broke the flashing arrows, the shield, the sword, and the weapons of war. Glorious are you, more majestic than the mountains full of prey. The stout-hearted were stripped of their spoil. They sank into sleep. All the men of war were unable to use their hands. At your rebuke, O God of Jacob, both rider and horse lay stunned. But you are to be feared. You who stand before, who can stand before you when once your anger is roused? From the heavens you utter judgment. The earth feared and was still. When God arose to establish judgment to save all the humble of the earth, surely the wrath of man shall praise you. The remnant of wrath you will put on like a belt. Make your vows to the Lord your God and perform them. Let all around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared, who cuts off the spirit of princes, who is to be feared by the kings of earth. So you have first, when as the psalmist is turning on the lights, he shows you. He says, Judah, in Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. His abode has been established in Salem. God is home. God is in charge. And nothing that could come in could stand against him. So he doesn't make them feel guilty. He doesn't tell them you're being a childish. He doesn't tell them, well, have you forgotten anything? He reminds them of who's in charge, of who's home, of who stands against all of our enemies. And notice how he talks about this. What I find interesting about it, as he says, his abode is established in Salem, and some of yours will say the tabernacle, which is an interesting word, because he is either illustrating the time where David brings in the tabernacle and the temple is starting to gain material, or David is starting to gather material in order to build the temple that his son will eventually start. And so Asaph is talking about, and you can imagine the picture he's drawing of, look at, the tabernacle is coming in. God is home. What are we afraid of? The mountains that surround us, the enemies that surround us, God is known in Judah. In Israel, his name is proclaimed. But in a physical sense, this kind of doesn't make sense. Jerusalem is one of the most conquered cities in history. I mean, this city has been, will be, and is currently in the process of changing hands, of being conquered, of being used as a bargaining chip. I mean, this is something that happens today. So what he's talking here is, it's more than just the physical city. It is more than just what they see in front of them. They look at this and see Jesus, or God, is in his house. God is in his house. And when his name is known, nothing can stand against him. Nothing that you can imagine, nothing that is real, nothing can withstand him. But there is a connection between Jerusalem knowing God and God's protection. Of saying, because God is known, this is what God has done. You know, one of the greatest, one of the truest cycles that we see within the Bible, in the Old and even in the New, especially in Revelation, is the cycle of turning to God. Or at first, God's people, God's children, decide for their own what they want to do, what is right and wrong. In so doing, they fall. And so God has to do the only thing he can in order to turn them back, which is to punish them or to discipline them, to give them pain and suffering, to give them something to show them they need to come back to God. It can be the form of a judge. It can be the form of a savior. It can be the form of judgment itself coming down upon a city. And at their lowest point, it is then that they turn to God, and God showers his protection upon them, making them, hopefully reinforcing to them, that God is there to love them, to protect them. This is where he wants us to be. He doesn't want us to be at the lowest point, but he is more than communicated to us that he is willing to take us there in order to show us that we need to depend upon him. Does that make sense? As he talks to them and says, this is what God wants to give Salem, to Jerusalem. This is what he wants to give to his people. He wants to give them protection. He wants to defend them. He wants to do all of these things. But he's got to be known. You can't have both, which is something that I want, right? I mean, that's honest. That's what a lot of people, that's what a lot of critics, at least in my experience, have leveled against the church. You know what I mean? That how can a God be so loving and yet bad things happen? You know, how can I live without God and yet when I'm punished by him or I'm perceived to be punished by him, why can't he just love me when I'm doing whatever the heck I want? It's like, nah, that's not how he works. That's never how he's worked. Never. His name has to be known. His name has to be known. And this is an active knowing. This isn't just a listening. This is a hearing it, it coming into your very presence, into your being, and you living that out. That is the knowing that he is talking about. God's name is known. And remember, you're seeing the tabernacle come into Jerusalem. This is the picture that he's trying to draw for people who are scared, for people who might not feel that God is within their presence. He's showing them, no, look. Look at what's coming into their city. God is here. And as he says, glorious are you, more majestic than the mountains full of prey. And he talks about a God who makes the strong weep, that they can't even use their arms. Verse 8, from the heavens you uttered judgment. The earth feared and was still. You know, and I'm noticing a lot of fear in this, used in both ways. Where it says God does something, and fear is the response to this. Or whereas kings come to God and they fear because of that. And the other where Asaph says, you better be afraid. Do you know who's in charge? Here's what I love about being a dad, all right? This is what I love about being a dad. It's really, it pumps up the ego. Is whenever my kids are scared of something or somebody, and I come in, I'm like, don't worry, kids, I got this. Like, where are you, bears? Like, get out of here, you know? And I open the door or the window, kick them out. And I come back out like, honey, I took care of it. And what's really great, when Natalie's like, oh, Joe, you know, and the kids are like, dad's the best, right? That is the best part of that. Because to them, they're like, wait a minute, my dad can beat up bears? There's a little bit of fear in there. I mean, again, Thomas has no fear, but my girls, there's still a little bit of fear. You know, once, you know, the thing that you're afraid of, the thing that always seems to be the greatest villain, and that seems to be just swept aside by somebody, you have to look at that somebody and think, oh my goodness, what are we dealing with? You know, Legion, when Jesus goes in, and I love the story that's found in Mark, but it's everywhere. That after Jesus, you know, he gets on the boat, he's on the boat, he's asleep, the storm comes, that's right, I'm getting my Jesus mixed up, and Jesus comes out, because his apostles are freaking out, and they wake him up, so he comes out to the top of the boat and says, shh, be quiet, in the boat, quiet, and it says the apostles are freaked out, you know, like, they're like, what is this, who's this guy that the winds and the seas obey him, and that would be awesome if that story was left there, but it's not, you know, the boat ends up, I imagine, running ashore, and the first thing the apostles do is spill out of the boat, and they find themselves in the middle of the night in a cemetery, in a graveyard, with someone screaming in the darkness as mist is rolling down the hills. Right? I've said this before, but I love it so much. And so, you know, because the apostles have got to just be losing their mind. They just want to get on earth. And so as they get on earth in the middle of a cemetery at midnight with fog rolling down and Thriller playing in the background, this guy comes screaming out of nowhere, and the first thing he says is, oh, by the way, I have a legion of demons in me, Jesus, don't kill me. And Jesus is like, all right, I won't kill you. And his apostles are like, what? Isn't that your job? Like, kill the dude, you know? And Jesus, no, just get out of him, you know? And you see that, and you see that miracle happening, all right? The demons leave the demon-possessed man. Legion leaves, goes into a bunch of pigs and does whatever pigs do with demons in them. And what I find incredible is the after part of that story. So the legion, or the guy, the now healed man, who everybody in the town was scared of. He's got scars and he's still probably shackled, and no one is accepting of him. No, he's been ostracized. He's been set out, definitely set out, if not just completely kicked out. And he asks, he goes to Jesus and says, "I want to follow you. Please let me follow you." Which makes sense because no one else is going to want him around. And Jesus does what I feel like to be the most un-Jesus thing, but that would be me. I'm glad I'm not. And he says, no, I want you to stay here. I want you to stay here. Show them I'm not to be afraid of. You should fear me, but I'm not the enemy. Right? Because to them, the man who healed or destroyed the legion of demons, that man. And then it says they feared him. And so Jesus had to leave because the community he was around was too afraid of him. You know, there's a level of fear that we have to have in our Christian walk. There's a level of fear that we have to have in our spirituality. There's a fear that must temper us, that must guide us, that is a usable tool in our chest that we have to have, because we're dealing with a God that is stronger than our fears. And if we're afraid of our fears, we should also have a healthy dose of fear for the one who says, I've got this all under control. However, I feel like the most understated word, the word that I believe this whole psalm rotates around, is found in verse 9. And after this, we'll be done. It says, when God arose to establish judgment to save all the humble of the earth. Now, I think that was, and I said that with an H, Dave, but because I almost wanted to, I'm like, humble. I almost wanted to say it like Dave says humble. Someday I'll get there. But I believe humble is, this is the word that this psalm rotates around. I think it's what makes fear worth it. And what it makes God's salvation make sense. Because without the humble part, it seems like a very very bravado. There's a lot of machismo. There's a lot of, and hopefully I'm saying that right, there's a lot of big manly things going on, of where you have a God destroying the predators of the mountains, where he's destroying swords and shields and strong men. And yet he throws in that humble, that to save all the humble of the earth. And I think that's what what this psalm is trying to give us. He's trying to show us a God who's in control, a God who puts into place all of our fears. And he reassures us with his protections that he's in charge. And by doing that, we must respond with a sense of fear, knowing that God is in charge and that our fears are very much real, perceived or not. But God is still in charge. But also, that should cause us to have a sense of humility in that, knowing that we can't save ourselves from this. You know, at first I was wondering, like, man, should I ask you guys what your fears are and just have a session of where we can just talk about what we're afraid of? You know, I have a healthy dose of what some would call a fear of spiders. I just call it a nice respect. I hate them. They all should burn. But, which our house is infested with, you know. But I have a healthy fear of spiders. I do, perceived or not. I just don't like them. I feel like they're crawling on me right now. And the truth is, God is in control of that fear. You know, I'm afraid of not being able to provide for my family. I'm afraid of a collapse. I'm afraid of a flu hitting my children. I'm afraid of far worse things. And we all can share those fears. Fears of losing our homes, fear of losing our jobs. You know, we hear them on Facebook. We hear them on the news. And we're like, thank God we don't have that. I'm afraid of that. You know, I had a friend who's my age. He's got two kids. He's my age. Healthy guy. You know, he went in one day because he was feeling something in his gut. You know, that wasn't right. He goes in thinking it's indigestion or something like that. He's got cancer. You know, he goes through a chemo set and, you know, he goes through all of that, comes out. He's healthy for 2 weeks. He goes back in. Something's wrong. And he looks at it. He goes, oh, your cancer's back. It's in the bone now. You know, thank God they had a treatment plan available for him, and now he's cancer-free. But that's a good story. We know a lot more bad stories, and I'm afraid of those. And that humbles me. You know, I understand there's a level of fear that I must have in a God who's in control, because he is in control and I am not. But that causes us to be humble about how we walk this earth. You know, this morning, when we talk about chances and when we talk about God being in control, when we talk about this is in the class with Eddie. You know, he's talking through Ecclesiastes, which is an incredibly depressing book. And he talks about, it just seems like the random nature of God, which is true. But the thing that makes it worth it is God is in control of this. And we should respond with humility and fear. If you have any needs this morning, any needs whatsoever, please come forward as we stand and as we worship God.